This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu wassalam rasulillah. Welcome back to Imam Talk, and we have here a special guest, Dr. Shadi Al-Masri. Welcome. Welcome. This is the first time we're meeting, actually.
First time we're meeting. I did hear your name about connected to some of my students who are on Legacy.
Yep, I was going to say, we have students in common, which is a special thing, and they speak highly of you, and I think highly of you. I've been following your work for a little bit. So, I really appreciate you being on the program and taking time to be here.
My pleasure.
So just give us a sense of one of the things that we try to do for Imam Talk is talk about what was your pathway to religious leadership? What was your pathway? How did you kind of come up into the positions that you are in currently? And maybe give us an idea about what are the different things that you have going on currently.
Sure. So for me, it was very simple. It was that when you observe people and you observe people who you never think of leadership, but you observe people who are given direction. And essentially, if you think about it, telling us how to live, that's what Shiyu do. And they tell us what to believe about Allah. This is the most intimate thing possible. What to believe about your creator and yourself, your origin and your future. And get into the world of how to show that, how to prove this or how to, pass this on. And you can only do so with evidence. And then you have to study those evidences. And these sources in the Quran and the Sunnah is built on a spiritual element with yourself, but also hand in hand, never separated from it, is a social element where you have to go out there and tell people about this. It's like a code red. It's a 5-alarm fire that you have to tell. Isn't that the first thing in the Dawah of the Prophet ﷺ? He said, if I tell you there's an enemy coming, what do you do? Mm. So it's a 5-alarm fire. That's literally what this message is. Mm. And so it grips you right away because it's giving you literally the most compelling, it's the most compelling message and piece of information that you're ever going to come across, which is that there is an eternity after this. And what we do regarding this book and this messenger is going to dictate an eternity. So once you're exposed, the moment you're exposed to that, there's really no going back. You can't put that back in a bottle and put it away, right? And act as if you never heard it. So you end up having to eventually make a decision. Am I doing this or not? Because this is an eternity we're facing, we're talking about. You either believe it, you're all in. You have to be all in. Something's wrong with your calculations about when eternity's on one scale.
Yeah.
Very little could defeat that, right?
You got to burn your boats. Right?
You got to khalas. This, you're either all in or you're all out.
Yeah.
Right? You cannot possibly, it makes no sense, no rational sense. Mm. So hearing that message when I was young, you immediately buy into it at one level. You grow up, there's a re-examination, and people either buy into it again, right? There's always, I think, always, all people have a time where they have to re-examine the matter, right? Mm-hmm. When they get tested with something, and sometimes just longevity. So it's hearing that message, right? Hearing the message and seeing people doing that, seeing people drive up, give classes, give khutbas, tell us, oh, this is what's going on here. Is wrong and it's got to be fixed. Or this is something amazing that has to be shared with everyone. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get a, like, targhib and tarhib. Sometimes you see it's a warning against, oh, well, we're going astray. When you hear someone say that, that means that the implicit thing is that there's a straight path. There's a wrong path. You got to now help people. You got to warn people, protect people. And you got to warn against people who are, ruining this straight path or misleading people. It was in New Jersey that there were shiuch, plenty of preachers and shiuch. Their life was exciting, right? And it was meaningful, extremely meaningful and exciting too, going up and down and sometimes feuds even. Hmm. Some people think that feuds are always bad, but they're not always bad.
Shows that you care, right?
Huh?
It shows that you care.
It shows that there are two parties who care and that you get sucked into the feud. You will choose a side. And for most people, if there's no feud, there's not a big deal. There's nothing worth fighting over. But having come into that, modernists on one side, you know, the people who are doing the deen on the one side and the modernists on the other side, immediately you have to study. You got to think. Mm-hmm. Now, no youth, I don't think, 13, 14 years old, really is calculating what's happening, but you're in it right away.
Right. And kind of the ecosystem that you're surrounded with. So you're saying that this was part of your upbringing then? Like you're saying that this was the very much the... And that was in New Jersey or where?
That was in New Jersey, and it was a time where there was like, I would say, I guess you could say retired scholars. Mm. And there were a couple. Sometimes they come in to move to America, and sometimes they just retire and move to America to give dawah and teach the small burgeoning Egyptian community that was here. And there were one or two was extremely fiery, passionate. And I guess I caught the bug, right? A good bug. I caught the flame, I should say. Right. No, I caught the overall flame. Yeah, I caught the overall flame. You may later on tweak some things, but I did catch, no doubt about it, caught the overall flame. Mm-hmm. And that's how your vision, your mind is set. Mm. And it wasn't hard before I realized this is the most important thing. There's nothing more important than this. There's a lot of things I wish I would have loved to have done. Mm-hmm. But every time I put that on one scale and this message on another scale, like this is way more important. And it seems like it's not taken care of.
Right. Yes.
We don't have like the Ottoman Empire that's got 1,000 ulama and an army taking care of the deen so I can just become a calligrapher, an artist, or
right.
Or, you know, something like that. This is like, it's a chaos, born in chaos, right? And so you realize, all right, we got to stabilize the religious message that's out here.
That's wonderful. Chaotic. Yeah. So you took that fire, and where did it lead you? What did you do? What were the steps that you took to kind of get to where you are today?
Well, it died out when the sheikh moved. Mm. It died out slowly. And it climaxed at Hajj. I made Hajj when I was only 14 years old. Mm. Right. And when you make Hajj and you're 14, you go from your little world of your elementary school, your soccer club, your intermediate school. And then you do know that there's another side of you that nobody knows about. Mm-hmm. Right. None of your friends could fathom what's going on in these mosques.
Right.
Not like it's something from the political or the legal element, but just the message itself and the people you're seeing in the masjid. Felt like you're living these two lives. And we went to Hajj, you see the whole world's at Hajj. And in the back of my mind, the world that I come from in a suburb of New Jersey, nobody from my school can fathom what's going on here. Nobody has seen more languages, has heard more languages, seen more cultures. And this is 1994, before modernity had really spread to a lot of places. Right? There's a lot of oddness, relatively odd to you. You know, cultures that the internet today, you can see all the cultures in the world.
Right, right.
Everyone's, even villages, like Matt Walsh goes to these villages and you get to see villages of Africa right on your phone. So but back in that time, you got to imagine that you're not exposed to that stuff. Mm-hmm. So to you, it's odd. Obviously to them, it's normal. That's the cultural relativism, you know, it's relative. So, but seeing all these people, there's something implicitly down, deep down. It's like the whole world has Islam, right? It's only us that are way over on the edge of the border of the Ummah, but the whole world has Islam. You know for sure the Christians have nothing like this. The Jews have nothing like this. Mm-hmm. The Hindus have nothing. Nobody, atheists have nothing like this. Nobody has anything like Al-Haramain al-Sharifain and what goes on in these places. Nobody. So you go in and you're set. Now, mind you, most youth will later on, they'll be able to put pen to paper on what actually is happening in their heads. But at the moment, you know that nobody's got anything on Islam. Although Islam may have some things that you're like wondering, how do I explain this to people? Mm-hmm. You also know that nobody's got anything on this religion.
Yeah. That's a great point too, you know, to remind parents is that is a wonderful age to take your kid.
It's on. It's so important. 13, yeah, that's 14, why we started something. We started something called Umrah for Youth. Mm. Just because of that, I know for sure that it's an impressionable age and they see the whole world doing this. they'll be set.
Yeah, you walk people, a little taller.
Yeah, people, they walk a little taller. They'll have their heads up. They have no problem now coming to the masajid, wearing thobes, and praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and having iman. But what ended up happening is that that light, it dims a little bit, right? It dims over time. And I had a dry spot and a bad spot, relatively speaking, right? Not going to be a bad spot like the way some people tell these amazing convert stories, right? It's nothing like that. But it was a dry spell, and I felt like something's terribly wrong. It needs, this is not right what I'm in right now. What I'm doing right now is not right. This is not good. And then came along a couple tapes and some Hamza Yusuf tapes. And that was basically a kickstart. It was a kickstart, and it was now I'm 17, about to turn 18. And now I'm starting to start thinking about ideas within Islam, as opposed to just that Islam is, when you're young, all you're thinking about is, okay, I just can't do that thing, and I should do this thing. Mm-hmm. It's very binary and simple, but that's how you express your loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this guy, Hasan Minhaj, this comedian, he says, he makes fun of Islam, saying that it's a transaction with God, because if you do these things, you get this much credit. Now, you know, my response to that is matters of the heart require a physical, objective way to express themselves. Mm-hmm. If you go to any counseling, if the wife is upset with the husband, the counsel will say, tell your husband what he can do to make things right. Don't just say, I'm upset and you know what to do. Right. And if you don't know why I'm upset, that's a bigger problem.
You're right.
Right? That's what a lot of people say. If you don't know why I'm upset, then we got bigger problems, right?
Not my job to educate you, right? That's what they would
say. It's not my job to educate you why I'm upset, tell you why I'm upset. You should know. And you need to make it right. Okay, now the guy doesn't know why you're upset, and he doesn't know how to make it right. So human things of the heart, they need to come out. Like, what is art? Something's in his heart, and he brings it out, right? But he's got to put paint on the canvas. And so what this religion does is that I remember at a certain period of time saying to myself, I have this iman. I may have a lot of wasawas and mistakes, but I need an objective way to show Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I'm with this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I believe this. Then I came upon the hadith, as-sadaqatu burhan. Sadaqah is the proof. You have iman, but it's mixed with a whole bunch of gunk. You want to prove that you're siding with iman? All right, here's an objective action you could do to prove it, right? Not to prove it, but to reflect it. So in that, that's the way I went. I need something objective to show what's really feeling in my inside. Words mean nothing, right? So that's what that knowledge benefited. And I started latching on to things that you can do to express yourself objectively. And that's the route that where knowledge and fiqh became extremely special. Because it shows, all right, I want to please my creator. I want to show that I'm faithful and I believe this. I need something to do. Gotta give me something. Do this, don't do that. It's gotta be, even if it's minor, like entering the bathroom with your left foot, exiting with your right foot. It's a micro expression.
And the marriage example is very powerful, because even in marriage counseling, they talk about the concept of currencies, right? It's like, so you can be spending, okay, and shelling out a lot of cash, but if it's not in the currency that your spouse is looking for, then it's worthless, right? And they're looking for a certain currency. Well, then why should it be any different with our creator?
That's the same thing.
I can go stand out in the sun all day and say that, well, that's my genuine expression of thanks to my creator. But if he's not reading that, or, you know, he doesn't accept that from me as a legitimate expression of gratitude and thanks, then what good is it really, right?
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So once I got into that world of fiqh, I became, and I think it's fitrah. It's fitrah, right? We understand relationships. Right, people understand relationships, and the divine speaks to us in a very similar way. That this is how I want things to be done. This is how you prove your faith. you can't have something where I go over the top and you're still not happy. Like, I need to know what makes this creator happy, pleased with me, and not pleased with me, right? There's a lot of stuff that goes on in people's heads that Allah forgives, right? But what matters is when the moment of truth comes and there's a hukum, do I obey that hukum or do I not, right? And then there's a hierarchy of ahkam. Certain things I can't do. Nobody can do, right? They're too much. There's a hierarchy. This is the obligation. This is the prohibition. Within this realm, you're good to go. You want to do more? Do as much as more of this and decrease as much as more of that. That's makruh and mandub. So I became obsessed with that way of going about things. And then the way, like you asked, the way to like where things are now is that you got to spread this. I would, as many people, I'm sure you're not no different. You can't read these things and just sit on them. What's the point? You need to, it needs to spread to other people.
So was that a career decision that you made? You went, you know, you were making these decisions to go study this. Where was, where did the study take place? Was it mostly here? Like, you know, how did it go? How did that affect like your professional course? Because that's fairly rare, right? There's what we have in the Muslim community that I joke and call it the Holy Trinity, which is doctor, lawyer, engineer, right? And if somebody who's a young person right at the cusp of adulthood, and they have the opportunity that, and they have the zeal to go study what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants of them, it's a fairly rare thing that that person actually, you know, actualizes that. So what were the, what were the steps, what were the decisions, what were the institutions that you, that you passed through?
So there, there, my thought process was, it was a bit different. It was that I'm going to study and whatever else happens, happens. And however things happen, happen. Now, having this reckless approach to things, because I knew, like, alhamdulillah, we never needed for any money. I never heard a discussion about bills and money. Never even heard one in our house. Never saw really much checking for prices. So money consciousness in my mind when I was young was zero. It was just a given. There's always food. There's always things are taken care of, right? It was a given. Resulting from that, you get to live in your own head. There was never a practical need for any money. So I never thought about making money or how the world works. The lights are always on. That's it, right? That's there's always gas in the car. You just give the guy a card and there's gas in the car. So my mentality was, I'm living in my own head. Luckily, alhamdulillah, fortunately from Allah, it was in a good direction. You could have lived in your own head, you know, for something useless.
But it kind of freed you up maybe to have larger concerns.
Totally freed me up, and I'm living in my own head. And all I'm thinking about from the age of 17, I would say, end of my age 17 into age 18. Probably until recently, I don't think about anything except ilm and suluk and da'wah. That doesn't mean I study all day. Everyone's got a different measure, right? And my measure oftentimes is what da'wah works, like what works in the field of da'wah, in the field of community, more so than diving. Some people dive into books so deep, right? And they become specialists. I never went that route. I didn't feel it was practical. So, but every living moment was just thinking about that, right? And then how to make money out of this and how to actually have a career was something that probably thought of like later on, but never actually thought of it from the beginning. That's why if you're reckless, but you're on the right track, Allah sends you someone to protect you. Right. And then that's where my parents said, you have to get a formalized education, which I did kicking and screaming. Did not enjoy one second of it. Didn't respect. Not only did respect, I was an open enemy to the Orientalists.
And we're going to get there, inshallah. I have some questions about that.
Sure.
Recently, you saw your debate.
Yeah, purposely did not attend as much as I could. Despised every minute of this separation between studying Islam like a dead cadaver with your arrogance and your colonizer mentality. Versus the actual deen. So that ended up taking me from Rutgers, did some nonsense degree. I don't even know what the degree was, to be honest with you. It's completely useless. And then, but it was just something to be called a BA. Mm-hmm. And then I did study Marxism and study different religions. That was something, okay, fair enough. It's, you know, fringe footnotes stuff to study, to know in your head. But then I went to George Washington University. And the only reason I went there was because there was a sheikh named Mohsin al-Najjar who was there. And I wanted to study with him privately. So that was my motivation. That's luckily, right. I also found a Mauritanian scholar in Washington, and I studied Arabic with him. And I learned, you know, the Ajrumiyya like the back of my hand.
Yes, Allah. MashaAllah.
Then I went to England, London, England. I tried to go to Abdul Hakim Murad in Cambridge, but I ended up going to London, England. And that was a blessing because Cambridge is a tiny town with very little Islamic activity. Now it has a lot with Cambridge Muslim College, but at the time it wasn't. And London is filled with Islamic activity, right? So I went to the University of London, but most of my time was spent going to different shuyukh and majalis that were there, soaking up as much as I could, finding any excuses to go study abroad. And alhamdulillah, I did almost like most of the summers there, went to different countries. And of course, there's a network, as you know, once you meet one sheikh, there's a network of shuyukh, and that's where... that's what I do.
Super. Well, that's really interesting and important because, you know, a lot of people, you know, we have like different tracks. Like, so there's somebody who might, they might come into consciousness about Islam or want to study Islam more once they get into college, but they're not aware of the whole Orientalist package. Mm-hmm. And so they get blindsided and colonized all over again and brainwashed and stuff like that. But you managed to make it through despite all that. And this is a real commonality that you and I have, because actually studying sort of colonialism is what brought me to Islam in the first place when I was in Vassar College, my bachelor's in political theory. Because what I came to realize, you know, without taking up too much space, but I'm going somewhere with this, is that the liberal reforms and the liberal sort of progressivism that is dominant now is simply the latest wave of colonial endeavor, right? Mm-hmm. It's the latest imperialism. And I came into college as like a Marxist and anarchist, you know, these sorts of things, a feminist. But when I realized that, it really set me back to zero. It cleared the pathway. And I happened to also come to know some Muslims at the same time. And that was what got me on the path of being interested and eventually converting to Islam. But not before I took a class on Islam in the same institution, and I was one of those naive guys. I thought that if you want to study Islam, you're enrolled in a university, what do you do? I take a class on Islam. What a mistake. But thankfully, it was so galvanizing for me because I was so enraged at the things that were being taught. I had so much... I guess jealousy and ghira for the deen before I even officially converted. It was absolutely, you know, like you said, you know, Allah sends you what you need. It ended up sending me down on a completely different path. The bridge to this and where I'm going is that recently, you know, you had this sort of discussion or this debate with a certain academic about the historical critical method and these sorts of things. This is an enormous issue. It's not even one issue. It's a constellation of issues. It's a package of issues that most people are not aware of. Tell us just, you know, briefly, like what is so wrong with this way of approaching knowledge? Because the counter argument, I got in a little bit of a dust up with a couple of people on the Blogging Theology Facebook group that are these sorts of Western trained academic Orientalist types. Because they're coming back and they're saying, well, you know, all of these methods, they're just methods and they have a certain descriptive power and it's really not that big of a deal. Why is that inadequate? And what is so wrong with this way of approaching the study of Islam?
Well, the historical critical method, you got to look at its birth. And history as a philosophy is never philosophically, history is not a neutral examination of the past. You are, as a historian, telling a story. That story is not a fiction, right? It's a nonfiction story that there are human beings alive today who will read that and form their own self-identity based on that history. Mm-hmm. The historian to me is an activist. Okay.
Has to be. It has to be, right? The historian can't not be an activist. Yeah. Right.
You are an activist.
Some realize that and some don't.
Mm-hmm. If you study Egyptology, where there are no pharaohs left in the world, right? Mm-hmm. There are still people in parts of the world that identify that's their part of the country and that's part of their history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they're either going to be proud or downtrodden by that. You as a historian do have a perspective. You're a human being. You will never be perspectiveless, right?
Mm-hmm.
You will have a perspective towards people, whether you know it or not, you will lean one way or another in how, what you choose to elevate of evidence, what you choose to put forth, whether or not you choose to search deeper for opposing evidences or call it a day on the opposing evidences, right? And keep pushing deeper on the evidence that you want there to be. So at the end of the day, you will be using actual evidences and sewing a story together. The reader will say, the common reader who's not a historian, not a philosopher, will look at this without much of a critical eye and say, all the evidence is here. And that's the conclusion, right? And he is like some guy in a suit and tie, and he's at a university standing upright at a lectern as if he's a computer, an AI that just produced this, right? As if he's not a human being that has an agenda. So everyone who gives us a fatwa, we as Muslims, for example, we don't take a fatwa from a fasiq.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You don't take a fatwa from someone who has no record. I find history is very much no different. If you're going to tell me my story, I need to know your story. Mm-hmm. I need to know your agenda, right? It's totally a fair question. Western historians, the method that comes out of it comes with a spirit. There is a spirit of doubt on every religious authority. Now, why is that? It's because the inquisition, the inquiry into history was born out of the abuses of the church.
Mm-hmm.
You go back, the Catholic Church, and we might have like some allyship with them now on certain moral issues. This church is one of the most oppressive institutions in history. And what they did to people. Now think about it. It's a bunch of guys. You bring a bunch of guys together and you say, listen, everyone's going to listen to you. They're going to oppress at some point. Some may not, and some may. They're going to oppress. When they discovered that massive elements of the story of the church was a lie. Mm-hmm. And they discovered this when they went about studying languages and comparing texts and looking at translations. Things that the church had barred them to do for a long time. Then now they're able to do it because the church has less of a stronghold over people after the Black Plague, the Black Death, or whatever it's called. So now they're studying languages. They're like, oh no, we've been lied to. So if your dad lied to you, you're going to start suspecting everyone else's dad is lying to them too. It's just natural projection. You're never going to trust authority again.
And those lies are very consequential. Just to give, you know, the viewer a sense of what we're talking about here, these are issues of life and death. Like we're talking about everybody who lives in North America should familiarize themselves with the doctrine of discovery and the papal bull that basically declared every single land in the world that was occupied by a non-Christian was fair game, whether it was a Muslim or a Native American, which enabled the entire colonial project for them to come and literally just plant the flag and say, yeah, that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is something that is exactly the fruit of the arrangement that you're saying. So this isn't just esoteric or obscure sort of theological points. This is real life and death stuff that people are making crazy decisions about.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the way of Iblis, how does Iblis produce a human Iblis? Right. Is by an injustice incurred upon that person that produces such a rage. And Iblis can redirect that victim to a worse injustice in making it look like a justice. When you read about the Renaissance, we're all taught this in school, right? You read about the Renaissance, you read about the Protestant Reformation, you read about the scientific oppression that happened to scientists, or the suppression of science. You're like, wow, this Catholic Church is the antagonist. It is the Hitler of that time. They are the Nazis of that time. Everything bad goes back to them. The socially and economically, you have these the feudal system And the church was all with it, right? Because they're hands in hands with the rich. So, and then the poor comes and you throw a nickel at the poor. So the poor could feel like you're giving them a shoulder to cry on. Mm-hmm. This is a good cop, bad cop operation, right? So at every turn in that chunk of centuries, basically after the Crusades, that chunk of time, for a couple of years, the antagonist is the church. So the historian, the scientist, that inquiry is born out of the enemy is the church.
It's a trauma that response, is then, really. It's a trauma response.
It's a trauma response. Atheism is a trauma response. Scientism is a trauma response. Even politically, like these popes have too much power. Why? What are you doing for us, okay, physically, to have all this power? So taking down the kings who are in it with the popes. All this is modern world's born out of a trauma response. That trauma never, nothing similar or close existed in the Islamic world. But then you got them. They're like, okay, we out of this trauma, we built a new world. It looks pretty good, right? Strike lightning with modernity, okay? Technology, technical revolutions, etc. You turn, they turn now their face on every other society with the mold that made them. That the dad is the bad guy, the religion is the bad guy, the king's the bad guy. Technology is a solution. Atheism is a solution. Yeah, that was for you. Right. And it, by the way, it wasn't a solution because look where atheism is taking you.
Right.
You got a serious problems in your society now. So, but in any event, they took that model, that mold, and literally like a cookie cutter, Africa, Japan, China, South America, everywhere else with that mold, and the weak-minded of every one of those civilizations bought into it. Right. Without ever, no, there's like no critical thinking here that your problem is not our problem,
right?
Your solutions could be our diseases, right? So to me, the people who go into Islamic studies and fall into this, I really view them as extremely emotionally weak, mentally lack of critical thinking, because they're not thinking outside the box. These academics have built a box, a sandbox for you and told you play, and you're playing. And I used to see these kids come in, regular mosque-going kid coming to the grad school, and just professor puts down the box. I'm like, these kids aren't that clever. They're going to be fooled, right? It's not book knowledge. It's almost some street smarts where you see them right before your eyes being fooled. Premises accepted. Snuck premises accepted. And all of a sudden, his DNA has changed.
Which is why it's also, it's very, very relevant, because somebody could argue or could say, well, that's why we need Muslims to go into the Islamic studies departments to change it, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, look at what cost, right? And who's doing da'wah to who, right? You enter in, you think that you're doing da'wah to the field. The field has a momentum. The field has premises, and there's only so much work that you're going to be able to do to push back. 9 times out of 10, you know, the field's doing da'wah to you and not the other way around. And the interesting thing that I found just anecdotally, and this speaks to your point, is that even the individuals that come from Muslim households or Muslim backgrounds that go this route, a lot of them do have almost a personal religious trauma with their own type of Islam that they grew up with, right? You find either the father or the grandfather or something like that with this very overbearing, sort of like crude caricature of a strict religious person that kind of whatever. And then the person, it's almost like you can feel sympathy for them because they're trying to salvage some sort of Muslim identity. But in order to do that, it's like they're trying to redefine all of what Islam is and say, well, Islam, it can't be the Islam of my father or my grandfather. It has to be this thing that just happens to coincide with all progressive and liberal values.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I really have to say, like, how bright are you, right? Because what a coincidence that all of your conclusions about Islam are literally the list of, you know, blue state, purple haired, whatever the latest thing is, that's what you've come to the conclusion of. And you're like, oh, we're brave, making a brave, how bold and brave when you're siding with 99% of the culture, right?
That's right.
So those types, they got played. The sandbox was made and you didn't even realize it. And now you're playing in it. And I like to go to the underbelly of what underwrites just the big things that we see in life. Like, for example, New York City, right? You go to see this massive, you've been to, obviously you're from New York, so you always go to New York City, right? Mm-hmm. So how far are you from New York City? Like
We're about 5 hours. Yeah, we're Utica.
Oh, so you're up.
Syracuse. But we go to the city often enough.
Okay, true upstate New York.
Yeah.
But you go to and you see these massive lights, these massive cities. And my curiosity is, what's underwriting all this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are the deals? Like, who owns these buildings?
Right.
Who actually, no one owns one of the buildings. It's like groups. And there's one guy's got 11%. Everyone else got like 8%, right? And then, like, how are decisions made?
Mm-hmm.
Who's paying what, right? Yeah. That's like what underwrites. That's the under. And then how is this stuff actually done? Like, how are these cities actually built? And then there are construction companies and you see them walking in and how they do their business. That's how a city is built. Mm-hmm. When I thought about someone who wants this naive, idealistic idea of we're going to change the academy, thinking, firstly, what is the academy and what underwrites it all? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's checks, right? People write for a check. At the end of the day, you may start off with one idea or otherwise, but you will move or not move after a certain age in your life. You will move or not move. What dictates whether I wake up and go right or left has to be who is writing me the check,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's what life ends up being. It becomes responsibilities. You have kids, you got a house, you got cars, you got a marriage, you got things to care about. Financially, people you care about that you have to take care of. And ultimately, that decision is going to get made, right? And you harden on the side of where the check is coming from. It's not that hard, right? Mm-hmm. And who's paying these checks at the end of the day? When you put in a book, I need to get this book out, right? I need to get a publication out because I'm going to apply for a tenureship. I need the publication. These publications are not coming from some neutral angel that's deciding, making the decision. There are human beings here. These human beings have parties. These human beings get together. They go out to lunch. They meet at conferences. They hang out. They're not unbiased creatures. And they're the people at Cambridge and Brill and all these other places that will make decisions on publications.
Mm-hmm.
It starts in newspaper, in journals, and then it moves up and up and up and up, right? And you got to always look at what underwrites it,
yeah.
right? And people tend not to go that deep,
right? Yeah, no, that's all very, very relevant to our times. You said something, and we only have about 10 more minutes. Unfortunately, this is going to be an abbreviated one. But you said something, and I want to transition there because I think it's a really important topic, and we're still going through it as a Muslim community. You know, you mentioned the Democrat, purple-haired, mm-hmm. states and the political agenda, and obviously, both another commonality that you and I have is very kind of outspoken critic of the LGBTQ lobby. And I recently went back over the podcast that you did with Mohammed Hijab and Dr. Jonathan Brown. We had that three-way conversation. It was a couple of years ago.
Yep.
And I really appreciated some things that you said there that I don't think are appreciated enough across the board with Muslim sort of du'at, etc., which is the kind of the issue that you were taking with this logic of, well, we need to support their secular right to do X so that they're not, so that the government's not going to come back and stop our right to do Y.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the problem with this sort of logic? Because this is one of the main barriers that people have from taking a moral stance and standing up and saying, no, this is completely wrong, and I'm going to actually agitate my political rights against it and try to reverse engineer this thing and flip it like the Catholics mm-hmm. recently did the Roe versus Wade, right? Mm-hmm. This is a big barrier for people. So how would you respond to that? Was this a complete miscalculation that some in the Muslim community did? And what's the way forward, perhaps?
People always feel that they want to be consistent, right?
Mm.
But consistent on what set of boundaries and rules? And according to whom? And what's the level of obligation? And what's the consequence? People feel that when they're in a secular world, I want to be consistent with the secular world, right? So as I want myself to be approved, I will approve of others. So number one, you're in a game, a sandbox to say, a world and a set of ideas that consistency with that will disallow you to be consistent with another set of beliefs you have, which is Islam. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's one thing. Now, consistency, number two, is why do you think you need to be consistent? Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you think anyone is asking your permission? Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think anybody really cares what you have to say? And if someone, now let's go to the consequences. If someone levies the charge at you, you're not consistent. Say, I'm not a secularist in the first place. Right. I'm announcing to you, and I am surprised that you are the Western countries. You've let Muslims in. That's your problem, right? Because we have our own law, right? Yeah. And we're not budging from that law to be consistent with yours, because in this law, I have a lot more to gain and lose.
Yeah.
On yours, I don't have much to gain and lose.
That's right.
I'm legally, it is totally permitted legally to be as inconsistent as I want to be. There's no consequence here.
It's an important point that you're making. I mean, we're policing ourselves, and we're kind of hamstringing ourselves. Yeah. In reality, we could be like, well, I'll be lobbying for my rights when it's for me, and when it's against me, I'm going to be trying.
Totally. And do you think, not that other people are our teachers, but do you think other groups out there are like, oh, we have to be pious, consistent citizens? Yeah. Or they just lobby for themselves?
Cheat to win is their motto. They'll do anything that they can to get their agenda.
I'll tell you one other thing that Muslims take an Islamic mentality, but put it in a secular. That's what they did. They took a good, righteous Muslim mentality, but you put it in a secular sandbox, right? Mm. In a secular set of rules. And you want to be pious and consistent. Well, you don't have to be. I was talking one day to a brother and saying, listen, so-and-so, he knows how to get you out of paying taxes. Right. And he knows all the tricks, the legal tricks to get you out of tax. One brother says, you know what? I never do that. I pay my taxes fully. I'm like, Ari, this is not zakah.
It's right? Uncle Tommen, right?
This is not even lawful by Sharia.
Right.
To pay the taxes the way they're making. Now, you know what? If they told us for North Brunswick, you're paying for this roadway, for this garbage, for this
water sewage. Income tax, 40% of your income, whatever nonsense that is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have no idea where it's going. And then they'll tell you, well, you know where it's going, but not specifically.
That's right. Guns, bombs, and bullets.
Exactly. So I'm like, brother, this is not even lawful. Mm-hmm. This taxation that they're taking your income like this is not even lawful. There is lawful taxation in the Sharia. It's very strict, right?
Yes.
So I'm like, for you to get out of it, first of all these tricks are lawful tricks, legal. They're legal tricks. Lawful in Islamic terms, we'll say legal in secular terms. Mm-hmm. They're legal loopholes to get out of paying taxes, right? So we're not even telling you to do something wrong. It's like rukhsa almost, right? Mm-hmm. But you cannot take this mentality of paying taxes like a pious Muslim is paying zakah. And that's how people went and approached this LGBT thing, where it's almost like, I want to be consistent, but no. You got it all wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I never really bought into, again, reviewing the arguments, the whole fear was that a government that is concerned with issues of morality is going to come back and bite us as Muslims.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sold on that scare tactic. I think that there's enough. And first of all, the Christian right is not a monolith. There's a big difference between Catholics and evangelicals.
Yeah.
And their attitudes or potential for alliances with Muslims. And I'm not sure that I buy that argument in the first place, right? Because if we bring the argument back onto moral grounds, I think we have really good arguments for things on moral grounds.
Yeah.
It almost seems like, again, we hamstring ourselves by trying to play in the secular sandbox, as you say, because then we're in not only, by trying to be consistent and trying to be kind of goody two shoes with it, but also, is it the right sandbox we want to be playing in the first place?
I would also look at the left does not hold that there is an actual truth in reality.
Mm.
Everything is relative,
right?
The right holds that there is a truth.
Yes.
Okay. We're at odds with their version of the truth. They're at odds with ours. when you look at the foundation, the right is closer to what is correct at the foundational level. Okay. You will butt heads with someone, a hardcore Christian. You will butt heads, but you are within an accurate foundation that there is a truth, that faith matters, God matters, afterlife matters. That's why you're butting heads. This person, although he looks like a severe enemy to you, it is rationally possible for him to recognize one day that his truth is wrong, your truth is right. With the left, they do not believe in an absolute truth at all, right? They don't believe in a truth or an afterlife or a God.
Yeah.
So it's much less fathomable that he'll ever recognize any validity to what you're saying.
And they've got their usul and their furu' mixed up. It's like we're going to jump in with somebody who happens to agree with a far'i issue.
Exactly. Right?
And their usul are all wrong.
Totally wrong.
And that's why people whose usul are, you know, yani, sound. And okay, they have furu' that are kind of whatever. Yeah. And we
that's
are
exactly it.
Running
the overall lens of the Christian is, all right, there's God, there's afterlife, right? Adam and Eve, God, afterlife, there's right and wrong in this life, right? And there's a message from God. That's a far closer framework, even though he hates your guts, than the other one. Now, it's the Crusaders and it's Qawmi Lut.
Right.
And the Ummah of Islam, this is a praise of the Prophet, is strong enough to withstand both.
Yes, sir.
Right. So let me tell you this, too. It's pretty interesting that one guy says, listen, he's another comedian making fun of Islam. And he goes, I don't mind you believing anything you want if that's what you believe, right? If that's what, you know, your identity is or what you have come up with. So the summary of that is we can accept your Sharia provided you admit that it's from your nafs and it's your hawa. Do whatever you want. The left will accept niqab if a niqabi says, this is my desire, my whim, and my identity.
Yeah.
They will never accept less than that. They won't even accept less than that if you say it's submission to Allah.
Yes.
So they want that, like you said, they want that usul. They're smarter as enemies, right? Mm-hmm. They are smarter. Do what you want. It doesn't matter as long as your usul. Like if you have a kid, I don't know how old your kids are, but you got to go for your
12, kids. 5 and 2, yeah.
12, 5 and 2. If your 12-year-old comes up to you one day and he says something to you, let's say he comes up to you and he says, I'm not going to raise my hands in front of ruku' and sujood anymore. And you say, oh, why? And he says, because I just like the way it looks, right? Mm-hmm. You get another one who says, no, I'm not doing it because I'm actually going to adopt. I really like the Hanafi usul on things. And I love Abu Hanifa and I'm convinced by the Hanafi usul. Mm-hmm. Or let me fix the analogy. Like say that kid and another kid says, I'm actually going to get up for tahajjud because, you know, it feels really good.
Right.
Which one is more reliable in your eyes? The one who's doing less, but for the right reason? Mm-hmm. Or the one who's merely emotional, doing something good, but his foundation's weak?
Yeah.
That's not the foundation. That's not the main foundation. Because I heard that it's healthy to wake up at 4 a.m. and it's healthy to wash your face.
Health benefits.
And it's healthy. Yeah. Huh?
Makes me feel less stressed at work or whatever materialistic benefits are.
Exactly. So one is doing less, right? Mm-hmm. But his foundation's right. One is doing more. But the foundation's wrong, right? So,
well, unfortunately, we have to cut this short there because we had some scheduling issues, and I have to duck out. But this is a wonderful conversation, and I really hope that we can pick it up for a round two sometime before.
Inshallah, we'll pick it up. It was my fault. I had
no worries.
Scheduled situation that made me late, but we'll pick it up in the future, inshallah.
Okay, Barakallahu Feek. I really appreciate offering your time and your thoughts. This is a great conversation and an important one, I think, too.
Inshallah,
my pleasure. The readers benefit. So, subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika, ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Thank you very much, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.